Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Alex DeBoer.
I'm Sam Jones.
And I'm Zoe Power. It's Thursday, October 4th at 5:06 p.m., and we're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
It's just 2 weeks until our municipal election, and this year Vancouver has an amended bylaw that expands its mobile voting services. So originally Vancouver created mobile voting stations for people who live in Vancouver who have physical barriers to them going out to the regular voting stations and voting. But now the city has expanded these mobile sites to include social service locations for folks who face other barriers such as mental health and drug addiction barriers. So I spoke with Vancouver's elections officer, Rosemary Hagawara, earlier this week to learn more about these expanded services.
We are then turning to an interview with CBC's municipalities reporter, Justin McElroy. Justin just wrote a story for the CBC on how UBC became Canada's largest community without a municipal government.
After that, we have a fun new segment called Facts with Jack.
Yeah, how is Jack spelled in this Facts with Jack, Zoe?
Facts with Jacked. This segment features our favorite University of Calgary political scientist, out of all of them, Jack Lucas, on some weird facts about Vancouver's local government, such as how our number of city councillors has changed, or has it, over time, and why our local elections happen every 4 years now, rather than every 2 years or every 3 years as they used to in the past. But first up, let's go to our interview with Vancouver's chief elections officer. That one doesn't rhyme with Jack. Elections officer, Rosemary Hagawara.
Here we go.
Would you mind just saying your name and your role with the Vancouver municipal election?
Rosemary Hagawara, chief election officer.
Awesome. Could you start out by talking a bit about the amended bylaw, which allows for mobile voting centers now to be brought to homeless centers and social service centers? For example, how did you decide which centers would be locations for mobile voting?
So the bylaw amendment went through in May, and that was based on research done by staff looking at what's the pattern down in it, especially in the downtown east side. We heard from 2014 that the voters down there were not participating in the election. So we wanted the opportunity to bring voting to them. And what we found through the research was that the residents in the area are more comfortable voting in their environment. They're familiar with the environment. So we've been working with the shelters, the administrators at the shelters and social service agencies, and just come up with a schedule, what works for them. What we've decided on was the high traffic time. So the schedule now is available on our website, and people can look at the times where we're there. We're actually servicing 32 locations over the period from October 9th to the 19th. And we're hoping that a lot of the residents will be able to attend at one of the facilities.
So mobile voting initially started out to give better access to voting to people with physical disabilities, or physical barriers, rather. And now it's expanded to people with, you know, mental health barriers or drug addiction barriers. Do you see this expanding even further to other marginalized groups?
We like to see what happens with the pilot after this election, and we'll have a debrief with the administrators in the centers and some of the activists in the area. We want their feedback as well. Yes, you're correct. The bylaw used to allow just for mobile voting at long-term care facilities and hospitals only. So we're very, very excited that we're able to expand to more facilities, and the response has been really phenomenal. So we're excited to get this going for them. And then, you know, again, we always do a debrief after the election to see what else we can improve on. The theme this time is we're bringing voting to the voters. So we're hoping that either we expand the program or they're happy with what we're providing, we'll continue on.
Great. to change directions a bit, I was wondering what you see the role of media being in Vancouver's 2018 election. Like, how important is media in getting people out to vote?
We really, really rely on media to help get the message out there. As you've seen, the ballot, the names on the candidates, there's a lot of names on the ballot, so it's a long list. We're hoping that the media could help us get the message out, you know, get your information on our website or the voter's guide, which is now available at community centers and the libraries. We have the Plan Your Vote tool on our website that can help voters select their candidates and then bring that information to the voting place. So get to know your candidates before you go, what you need to do to vote, to mark your ballot, and then come early. Go. We have advanced voting from October 10th to the 17th, so we've expanded that opportunity from 2014, so there's more advanced voting opportunities from 8 to 8, so come out during advance. The lineups will tend to be less than on general voting day on October 20th.
And with the new provincial restrictions on third-party advertising, we've seen that candidates and parties have less advertising dollars. So are you concerned that that might result in lower voter turnout?
Well, we're doing everything we can within our powers to get the message out there. I know the candidates are also very keen in getting the voters out as well. They have access to the voters' information, so they've been knocking on doors. Potentially, it's a thing that we were worried about, but again, we do our best. We can only control so much within the city. So getting the message out there with the help of the media, spreading the message out there, making voting easy for them. You know, we have the worksheet for the ballot, the randomized names. We have a worksheet in the voter's guide, and then utilizing the Plan Your Vote tool that we have available now.
I know that outgoing councillor George Affleck of the NPA suggested that the provincial government should spend more money on communications budgets for a group like, say, Elections BC, a nonpartisan group, in order to get the word out about our election. Are you in favor of something like that? Do you think that would help increase voter turnout?
Yeah, absolutely. Any way we can get the word out there. We've taken other social media to get the word out, getting the information printed available to anybody who needs it. So trying to make the information available to them as much as possible.
And when George Affleck made that suggestion, I don't believe it resulted in anything for this particular election, right? There is no increased communications budget.
No, that would be going to the province to get the funding he's requesting, yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time, Rosemary.
Thank you.
Last year, over 650 BC teens aged out of foster care without a permanent family.
Adoption is not just for babies. Teens need families too. Only 24 teens in BC were adopted last year.
November is Adoption Awareness Month. To find out more about adopting a teen, contact the Adoptive Families Association of BC. Call 1-877-ADOPT-07 or visit us at bcadopt.com.
All right, and we're back. You're on CITR 101.9 FM, and you're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's hour-long show, bringing you
dignity,
local current affairs from the Lower Mainland.
So now we're going to be turning to a piece on an interview with CBC's municipality reporter, Justin McElroy, who wrote a story for CBC on UBC becoming the largest community without a municipal government. So we will now be turning to that.
Hope.
Hi, my name is Justin.
The Beauty Knights.
Vancouver's municipal affairs reporter.
Very good to talk to you. So you just wrote an article for the CBC on how UBC became Canada's largest community without a municipal government. Can you tell our listeners what you mean when you say that UBC doesn't have a municipal government?
Yeah, well, it's if you live in any other densely populated part of this country, when local election season happens for your province, you vote for a mayor and you vote for either one councillor or a bunch of councillors, depending whether you have a ward system or not. That is the case everywhere in Canada with a densely populated area, except for the lands west of Blanca Street. It's been that way since UBC started as a university and since there were a few hundred homes sprinkled in the area. But over the last 30 years, as UBC has grown from only a university to a place that has its own 15, 20,000 people who permanently live there, and the rest of the land around the university has developed as well, it's become a bit of a strange situation.
So could you elaborate a little bit on the history there, if you don't mind?
Sure. So, the UBC student today would know that there's plenty of market housing that surrounds the university. People that live in homes that they own that have no real affiliation with the campus, whether it's south of 16th Avenue, north of Gage Apartments, or to the east. But it wasn't always that way, and things really only picked up in terms of that population after the mid-80s, when a university president for UBC named David Strangway decided, well, we own all this land that's not being used, that's either forests or parking, underused parking lots or whatever else, and we don't have a lot of savings in our endowment, which is the big way that a university is able to finance scholarships and capital funding and prestige graduate scholarships and the like. So what if we use that land? We allowed people to build on it, houses, but mostly apartments and condos, and people could buy their properties on 99-year leases. And they first tried this in the late 80s for Hampton Place, and it essentially proved so successful that the university kept doing it and doing it, and now to UBC there's about 12,000 people or so that aren't students that live on campus permanently. And so you've developed around that as well all these commercial companies, whether it's restaurants or other things that people use, and you have roadways that are much more used than they were 30, 40 years ago. You have basically all the, of course, sports arenas and the like, so you have all the hallmarks of a full separate community, but none of the governance where people, everyone who lives there, elects their local representatives to oversee things.
So, Justin, if UBC area residents can't vote for Vancouver City Council, why are they allowed to vote for school board and for one person on Metro Vancouver's regional board? Why this combination specifically?
Right. Well, at the end of the day, everywhere in British Columbia is part of a regional district. And so people that live in unincorporated areas throughout British Columbia, unincorporated means that they're not part of a municipality, vote for regional area directors. Of course, in most of those places, the director only oversees, 5, 10, 15,000 people that live throughout, hundreds of square kilometers sprinkled throughout many, many small towns and villages. For electoral area A, it's all the UBC lands and then Barnstrom Island and a few other small pockets of land in Metro Vancouver, but it's very different in that sense. And then the other thing is regional governments are in charge of overseeing land use for the entire region and putting together regional growth strategies and transportation strategies that everyone adheres to. Well, UBC is exempt from being part of Metro Vancouver's land use processes. They deal directly with the provincial government. So when it comes to things like rapid transit or contracts with various groups or long-term population growth planning, UBC isn't at the table, and the regional politicians say that's a problem. Now, in terms of school board, it's the same thing. Everyone's part of a school board one way or the other, and the schools that are on to UBC property or close to it, they're public schools, and people who live here send their children there, and so they need representation in that. But it just adds the part and parcel of you have so many weird overlapping jurisdictions at UBC land. But ultimately, the buck doesn't stop with any mayor of UBC City.
So, in your recent article, you quote UBC as saying their current government partnership is effective. You also mentioned that students usually leave campus before they get politically active. Is the impression you got from your reporting that in order for UBC to join Vancouver or get its own municipal government, it will require students to demand that?
It's possible. It would need a change from the status quo. And, my reporting here is informed by the fact that I've been reporting on this for 10 years. It was a big part of my focus when I was a news editor at the UBC literally a decade ago. And what tends to happen right now is when there's a big issue where students and the general populace don't like what's happening with UBC, whether they're planning on building something that they don't like somewhere or taking away some sort of right, students will rally and the provincial government may or may not change things, but there's no sort of municipal recourse. At the end of the day, the idea of getting to vote for someone is going to be a tough sell for students because by the time it would come into action, they would have probably left campus by that point. But it's something where if suddenly there was a demand for students to have some oversight that could help prompt the government to take more interest in this file than they do right now. But at the end of the day, you would need a specific issue that UBC was doing or a decision they were making that clearly was non-academic because, of course, it's not like the provincial government's going to interfere with the academic administrative decisions UBC does to force their hand. You know, a decade ago, there was a situation where the UBC farm was under threat of being developed. And the students rose up then, and the provincial government sort of threatened to look into the situation, and then UBC quickly changed their mind on being ambiguous as to whether they would protect it or not. So you would need some sort of spark like that, probably, in order for students to care. Otherwise, there's a reason why the status quo has existed for so long.
Thank you. So you describe Electoral Area A as having a mishmash of different legal authorities and groups responsible for different services, but no elected group linking everyone together, to quote you directly. So one group that stood out to me was the University Neighborhoods Association. Can you talk more about the role of this organization in particular when it comes to governing folks who live around UBC?
Sure. So the University Neighborhoods Association is basically the group that anyone that's a permanent resident on land that UBC owns is part of. So whether you're talking about Hawthorne Place, South Campus, or so several of the other areas directly under UBC's control. And in those cases, people pay a services tax that the UNA administers, and UNA gives it to UBC, and then that's given to the various groups, whether it's policing or fire or maintenance or whatever else, that service all of those lands. So this is what UBC and some UNA residents and directors, to be fair, say works very well because people can get elected to the UNA board and they can push for things that happen on their lands or noise bylaws in those areas or special events and their communication about new buildings or what have you. But at the end of the day, their power is limited. It's very much sort of like a glorified strata organization or something in a planned retirement community where there's some representation, but it's not enough to actually force someone's hand if they don't like what UBC is doing.
Okay. So one last question. Greg Moore, chair of the Metro Vancouver Board of Directors and mayor of Port Coquitlam, told you it would be hard to balance UBC's desire for complete oversight with compromises that would be required if it changed its governing structure in terms of regional transportation, growth, and affordability. Do you foresee UBC gaining a municipal government of its own or more inclusion in Vancouver's municipal government in the near future? Does either one of those seem more or less likely?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, no, it actually isn't. The answer is probably no. It requires, as I've said, people, whether it's students, whether it's residents, or whether it's the provincial government, looking at the situation and saying that something needs to change. And at the end of the day, that momentum doesn't seem to be there. So while other regional politicians look at some of the issues they have around growth and transportation and everything else and say, look, it would be way better if the university endowment plans and people living at UBC were part of this conversation in a more formal way than the one person elected to the Metro Vancouver board. That's been the case for decades, and that's not going to change the equation.
All right. Thank you so much, Justin, for your time. So thanks so much.
Okay, I got to go, though.
All right, yeah.
All right, and we're back. So you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard an interview that we did with Justin McElroy, the CBC's municipalities reporter, on UBC and its government, or mostly lack of. So there's an interesting article you can check out that he wrote for the CBC online about how CBC is the largest, UBC is the largest municipality without an actual government. So pretty interesting. As we come up to our election on October 20th, people here can only vote for one. Here being, you know, we're broadcasting from UC, people living on campus who have homes on campus can only vote for one school board trustee and someone from the regional, what is it called?
Metro Vancouver regional board.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so no one can vote for council. So yeah. Anyway, interesting. So we're now going to tune to a really delightful piece that I haven't heard that Zoe Power made. Zoe, did you want to say anything about it before we listen to it?
Does
it speak for itself?
Yeah. There's always something more to learn from Jack.
Jack Lucas.
Jack.
We love him.
Which other Jack would it be?
Which other Jack? Such an uncommon
name. Jack's back, everybody. Facts with Jack is back.
You may have heard Jack Lucas if you've listened to our podcast, Seeking Office. He features largely on part two of the How We Got Here series. He knows a lot of stuff, and we had to cut some of the stuff he knows out of the doc, which was painful. Talk about killing your darlings. So here we are reviving our darlings. Here's Facts with Jack by Zoe Power. Let's take a listen. Oh, just having trouble opening it. No big deal. Here we go. Oh. We're just dealing with some tech issues. So I'll just talk a bit about Jack Lucas because honestly, he's great. So Jack Lucas is a political scientist at the University of Calgary, and he knows a lot about Vancouver's municipal history because he has access to all the databases or all the voting databases from every election from the beginning of time. So, well, not the beginning of time. I think maybe the 60s. But isn't that the beginning of time? This is sort of like municipal comedy, actually, right now. You know, it's really hard to put on a live show because literally everything always goes wrong. Like, always. And it's not even our fault, like, at all.
I can attest to
it's
that.
It's a bit our fault. No, it's not, though.
There's this broadcasting system called Sam, which is, like, unrelated to
horrible.
The beautiful newscaster, Sam Jones. He's an absolute fruit. But Sam is just, like, the literal worst.
Yeah.
It's hard not to take it personally.
You should really listen to our podcast, Seeking Office, because we can edit that. And there's less mistakes. But you should also listen to our show now. Are we ready, Zoe?
Maybe.
All right. We're going to see if this works. This is Facts with Jack Lucas.
Hopefully. Fingers
Hopefully.
Crossed. Vancouver goes to the polls to vote in this year's civic election. And if you've learned just one thing from all of our coverage of this election so far this year, you'll probably know that 2018 is a super weird election cycle. We've seen big shifts happening in the city's political landscape, including the fracturing of existing parties and the formation of a whole range of new alliances. We've also seen changes made to the way that campaign financing works in the city, as well as a randomized ballot paper and a number of other changes which have voters confused.
Vancouver is voting in October this year. You can do it, step by step. Know what you're voting for.
But one thing you'd be forgiven for thinking was staying the same was what we're actually voting on.
You're choosing the leaders of your city for the next 4 years. one mayor, 10 councillors, 7 park board commissioners, 9 school trustees.
But where do these numbers come from? Those of you who've been in Vancouver for at least 2 election cycles at this point will remember that we didn't always used to vote in city councillors for 4-year terms. In fact, this current cohort of councillors, who are serving up until election day, will be the first group to have held their job for this length of time in the city of Vancouver. So why are we keeping our elected officials in longer? And given that the population of Vancouver has increased so dramatically since the city formed in 1886, why do we still only have the same number of councillors? Myself and News Collective comrade Alex DeBoer wanted to know the answers to these questions. So we got in touch with our Vancouver municipal elections expert, Jack Lucas, from the Political Science Department of the University of Calgary, to ask him about why it is that these aspects of our electoral system are the way they are. And that makes it time for Municipal Election Facts with Jack.
So I believe the number of councillors we've had in Vancouver over the years has ranged from 8 to 12. But today in 2018, we have 10 councillors. And that is the same number of councillors that we had in 1957. And so the population has obviously grown quite a bit in that 70-year span. So is that not concerning? Is that not sort of should we not be growing the amount of councillors in relation to our population growth?
Well, it's certainly true that city councillors in Vancouver today represent, if you were to kind of divide the population by 10 and assume that each of them represents a tenth of the population, that number is much higher today than it was in 1957 when the city went from 8 to 10. So absolutely there are more people per councillor than there were in the past. Now that's true of every Canadian city. So that's not a distinctive phenomenon in Vancouver. The number of city councillors in places like Calgary and Edmonton has shifted around a little bit over time, but it certainly hasn't grown to keep up with the extraordinary population growth that we've seen in Western Canadian cities. There are ways that constituents are able to communicate with councillors today that weren't available in the past. It may be that, you know, technology, the internet, social media, and those kinds of things make it easier for a larger number of people to communicate with city councillors. And the other thing you have to pay attention to is not just the number of councillors, but also the size of their staffs. So if you have one city councillor representing 30,000 people with absolutely no staff, and you compare that to a city councillor today who maybe represents roughly 60,000 people in Vancouver, but does it full time and has a staff of people helping the city councillor address citizen concerns and respond to their complaints and their preferences, then you know, it may not be that we have as big a problem as it seems. But, you know, it's just there's nothing quite as difficult in contemporary politics as making a case for more politicians. And we see that very clearly just with the transformation of the ward system in Toronto. It's very easy to kind of make this argument that we need to keep the number of politicians the same or even decrease them. There aren't that many people who are willing to step out and say, no, we need more politicians. But it is definitely true that if you doubled the number of city councillors in Vancouver, it would increase the cost of a municipal administration, but relative to other municipal costs, it wouldn't increase it that much. And it would mean that there were a lot more people who are available to serve on committees and represent the public and attend public events and so on. So there is a, even though it's not an easy case to make kind of publicly and politically, there is always a case to be made for more city councilors in a place like Vancouver that only has 10.
Right.
You know, if they had 100, you know, there's obviously some upper limit on ensuring that city council is able to make decisions, that the city councilors are able to work with each other and know one another well enough to make, you know, decisions together. But there's no question that 10 is not a magic number, and there would be plenty of room to increase the size if that was something that people in Vancouver wanted.
Yeah. In Vancouver, another change in our electoral system that's been very interesting to look at is how we used to have elections every 2 years, and then it became every 3 years, and now they happen every 4 years. Obviously, there are a lot of reasons for that, and I was wondering if you could give your take on why we've made this move towards having elections less frequently.
Yeah, this is another trend that I could have mentioned as one of the long-term trends that you see in every Canadian city. Certainly in Western Canada, this is true, where it was once the case where all of these cities had elections every single year for municipal office. Then it went to 2 years, sometimes rotating, where half of the city council would be up for election every 2 years. And then eventually you get to every 3 years and now every four. This, I think, just has to do with the professionalization of the municipal political career. There's increasingly the idea of what a city councilor is that's not a part-time amateur kind of role akin to being on the board of a local charity or something of that nature. It's much more that this is a professional political career. And so if the position is a professional full-time political career, then it takes time to come up to speed, that people can really learn the issues in, the first year of their time in office, and then have 2 or 3 more years to really act on that expertise that they've built up over time. And so I think that the change in the frequency of municipal elections really does have to do with the professionalization of that role as a full-time political career.
Okay. And would you see it at all as making the government less democratic because we're voting less frequently?
Well, more elections, I guess, in one sense, means more democracy in a sort of simple sense. But, you know, you have to think about other factors, too. If there were municipal elections every year, how would that affect turnout? Would people be eager to vote in municipal elections if they were happening every single year? Or is it a case that having an election every 3 or 4 years makes people more interested in the outcome? The stakes are higher. You know that these people are going to be in office for a longer amount of time. They're going to make really important decisions over the course of 3 or 4 years, and so you're more motivated to vote. I'm not aware of any analysis in Canada where people have actually compared turnout rates to the length of term, and actually it occurs to me now in saying this that it would be an interesting thing to explore. The shift to longer terms of office has been really quite uncontentious, I think. Certainly since in the last 3 or 4 decades, there hasn't been much resistance to the idea that if we have elections every 3 years, which was fairly standard until recently, and now every 4 years, well, that's what we do with provincial governments, roughly speaking. That's what we do with our federal government. So it's appropriate to do the same thing with municipalities.
So, there we have it. Vancouverites over time have elected less city officials per capita and have also done so with less frequency. But these factors have been offset by, as Jack mentioned, technological developments, as well as changes in the nature and complexity of municipal politics. Vancouver switched to elections every 4 years in 2014, and that's when all of British Columbia made the change as well. At that stage, we were kind of moving further into alignment with the rest of Canada. Ontario had made the switch in 2006, and Alberta in 2003. And when British Columbia eventually made the change, they became the last major province to do so. The only exceptions to this revised electoral system today remain the Yukon, which elects councillors every 3 years, rural municipalities in Saskatchewan, the Northwest Territories, and hamlets in Nunavut. So, although everything else about 2018's municipal election might be kind of weird in Vancouver, at least in some ways, we're moving closer toward the rest of Canada.
Vancouver is voting in October this year. You can do it, step by step.
I hope you enjoyed this edition of Facts with Jack, and good luck voting on October 20.
We're wondering if you...
or some other form of mental illness, there's a free course that can help. The Wellness Recovery Action Plan is an evidence-based program that works. It's developed and facilitated by peers who have experienced their own mental health challenges and have used RAP to recover and maintain long-term stability. It's based on the key concepts of hope, personal responsibility, education, self-advocacy, and support. For more information about the free RAP groups hosted by Vancouver Coastal Health, visit their peer-led website, spotlightonmentalhealth.com.
It's a brand new day.
Are you a graduate student? De-stress from your studies through the Graduate Student Society. Come and meet new friends through our beer tasting sessions, sports leagues, and fitness classes. And maybe you're interested in making a difference. Help eliminate sexual assault by volunteering to become a GSS Active Bystander Trainer. If ever you experience difficulties with your supervisors, faculty, or the university, the GSS can provide confidential advocacy assistance. And we will work with you to help resolve academic, personal, or financial issues. Your graduate student experience matters. Let the GSS help you now. Visit gss.ubc.ca.
All right, and you're back. You are listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. And we just enjoyed some fresh, hot coverage of cool facts about municipal elections in Canada.
Fresh, hot, and historical.
Yeah, that's how we do it.
So we're nearing the end of our show, and we have a bonus segment that we did not announce initially.
Surprise!
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 To everyone. So this is an interview that myself, Alex DeBoer, and News Collective member Logan did. I forget Logan's last name. What is it? Anyway,
Logie
Logues, great.
The Logue Dog, the Logue.
We just call him the Logue Dog. So.
He only needs one name.
So yeah. All right. So me and Logan interviewed a PR specialist at Citizen Relations, which is a public relations firm in downtown Vancouver, and this individual, Malcolm Brody, he has a lot of experience doing PR on federal and I think provincial as well election campaigns in the past. So we got him to give some insights and analysis on Vancouver's 2018 municipal election of sort of tactics candidates have taken to sell their own political message and brand. So let's take a listen to that, and yeah, then the show will be over. So you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM.
So my name is David Brody. I'm a senior vice president and general manager with Citizen Relations. We're a global PR agency with offices across Canada and around the world. But before my time working here, much of my early career was in politics. I worked for my first job in politics was working for the leader of the Alberta Liberal Party, and then worked for a number of federal Liberal campaigns across Western Canada, which then led to a job working in Ottawa with Paul Martin. He was finance minister, first of all. Then I also served as director of operations on his national leadership campaign and as a senior advisor in the prime minister's office with him as well.
Awesome. And can you share some of your observations about campaigns in the 2018 municipal elections?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the interesting things is although I've worked a lot in different campaigns, partisan politics, it's been primarily at the provincial and federal level. So this is a fight that I no dog in this fight for me. It's not one that I'm actively working on, but definitely watching with great interest. And I think it's an extremely unique election. I mean, you've got two parties, or I guess, you know, they've often called them electors organizations in the municipal context here in Vancouver, that have really dominated Vancouver politics for decades now, both simultaneously sort of imploding. You know, you have Vision Vancouver, who, you know, their mayoral candidates ended up dropping out of the race entirely, and they really only have one incumbent left from their city councilors who's running for re-election. The MPA, who, you know, has a very fractious nomination battle and now is split off into a number of different factions, you know, with Hector Bremner and the Yes Vancouver campaign, Ken Sim and others, you know, who have sort of broken away from the MPA as well. So the two parties that have traditionally controlled municipal politics here in Vancouver and in a bit of disarray, and because of that, a bunch of new parties emerging and a lot of independents running as well. And I think at the end of it, you're going to end up with, you know, needing somebody who can somehow bring that all together at the end of the election.
Interesting. And so building off of Hector Bremner as being one of these splinter forces, so in this election, we've noticed that he's been using sort of vaguely positive rhetoric to sell his particular political brand. And we've seen similar phrasing in past mayoral campaigns, such as with Gordon Campbell's Positively Campbell campaign slogan in 1986 in that mayoral race. I'm wondering if you can talk about the intention behind this type of and tone of positive political messaging.
Yeah, I think a lot of, in the case of Yes Vancouver, a lot of what you've seen, their message has all really centered around, is really a single issue. It's all been around housing affordability. And I think you're right, a largely sort of positive message that they've tried to bring forward around that. I think they've likely done extensive polling going into the last of this election, telling them that's, you know, an issue that's definitely top of mind for the majority of Vancouverites. For that matter, I don't think anyone would need to do a lot of polling to know that that's an issue that's top of mind for a lot of people in the city. And I think Hector being a candidate who skews a little bit younger, you know, I'm sure that they were anticipating sort of to be able to put together a coalition of voters that could elect him. They would really have to mobilize millennials here in the city, and recognizing that that was going to be a top-of-mind issue for them. And also, I think, looking at that segment of the electorate as one that probably more positive messages like that, they're a bit more receptive to traditionally as well.
Like, when you say that sector of the electorate, do you mean more conservative-leaning people tend to prefer more positive messaging, or what sort of, like, demographic are you talking about?
No, I think in that case, I mean, you're right, Hector has come out of the MPA, which tends to be, you know, the center-right leaning of the two traditional parties in Vancouver politics. But I think with his focus on housing affordability, he was really trying to target more younger voters and millennial voters, and their voters who a more positive message usually tends to resonate with a bit more.
So another thing we've noticed about Hector is that he has a lot of sort of short, catchy phrases that he uses to sell his political brand again. So he says things like park the politics and legalize housing as like these sort of really just tight little phrases that kind of sum up the core of his political platform. I'm wondering if you can comment on this and if it's again something that he feels or something that is more successfully responded to by younger voters, or why we're not seeing kind of more politicians do these same type of catchy phrases?
That's an interesting question, for sure. I think, I think that's been a part of his strategy, and I think he's not alone in doing that. I mean, if you look at going back a couple of years in Toronto municipal politics, I mean, Rob Ford, somebody who a lot of people may agree or disagree with a lot of what he did when he was mayor, but he also stuck to a very simplistic message, right? He kept talking about, you know, he was going to stop the gravy train at City Hall and bring down taxes, and that was really, regardless of what anyone asked him, regardless of the questions that came forward, that was his key message, and he kept drilling that forward in every opportunity he had. And I think in many ways, I mean, and he was successful in doing that. And I think with any campaign, I mean, if you can distill it down to a core message that resonates well with voters and continue to get that across in a simple, easily digestible way, a lot of the electorate is not that engaged, right? And it doesn't really start to think a lot about elections until the days or weeks leading up to it. And the more direct and easy to understand your message is, often the more effective you'll find it will be.
Right, but do you think this is sort of tied in with populism, though? Because it seems like a lot of people who are using these kind of reductive phrases, if you can call them that, tend to be more populist figures like Doug Ford or, like, I guess Hector Bremner in this case, or Donald Trump even.
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think you're seeing overall, across the political spectrum, whether it's on the left or the right, more populism and more of a fractured electorate, for sure, both in municipal, federal, or provincial politics, absolutely.
Okay, so we've talked a bit about positive messaging, but there are campaigns that take the alternative approach and use rhetoric that's largely negative and critical. What's the rationale behind this campaign approach?
Yeah, I think the usual answer to that question is, you know, most political strategists will tell you that the reason why campaigns often tack towards more negative messaging and negative campaign ads is because they work. I think that's a bit simplistic. I mean, I think really, what determines whether an ad, a good political ad, works or not isn't whether it's negative or positive in tone, but rather, does it connect with voters on a rational level, on an emotional level, and is there a segment of the electorate that your message is really appealing to, that you're connecting with? But there's a long history of, whether it's municipal, federal, provincial politics, of negative campaigns, right? I mean, if you look at the just in a Canadian context, conservatives in the last few federal elections certainly have had some success with their negative campaigns. When this may be going back in time a lot for you guys, but when Michael Ignatieff was leader of the Liberal Party, they spent a good 2-3 years prior to that election really defining him with a series of aggressive negative attack ads that ended up being very effective in that case. They had a message that, they knew that it tested, that would work well with voters, and they aggressively repeated it and really defined Michael as Liberal leader well before the election. At the same time, you've also seen negative campaigns, I think, backfire or be ineffective in a Canadian context as well. Probably one of the most famous examples in my lifetime, and this is going way back to when I was in high school when very first got involved in politics, when Jean Chrétien was running, and I believe it was the Campbell government at the time who ran a negative ad sort of attacking his physical appearance, and there was a huge backlash against that, and really played very much in Chrétien's favor, and you saw his poll numbers go up as a result of that, and really gained momentum going forward through that. And more recently, I mean, if you look at the last federal election, a ton of negative ads that the Conservatives, they tried to use the same tactics that they used against Michael Ignatieff in that campaign, in the Trudeau campaign, really saying he wasn't up for the job, he's just not ready, was sort of their campaign slogan that they kept using. Where it was ineffective there is I think they played so heavily on that messaging and lowered public expectations of him so much that when Justin Trudeau was able to come out in the first debates and make strong, rational arguments, it played so much against the image that the Conservatives had tried to portray of him. It just played very much against the image that they had tried to build. And they had almost overplayed their hand with the negative ads, trying to lower expectations so much.
Right. One thing we've also seen in this election is a couple of candidates who have faced repeated criticism over the same issue, in multiple interviews. And so they've started calling these criticisms smear campaigns. So I'm wondering, what would you advise to a candidate who is facing the same kind of questioning that they can't seem to win? Is it to just acknowledge that criticism and dismiss it by way of identifying it as a smear campaign? Or is there an alternative approach to this?
Really good question. Do you have an I'm just trying to think of a good example of that from this campaign.
Well, in this case, one example I'm thinking of is Kennedy Stewart. He's been repeatedly questioned about his critiqued for his failure to speak out on dem evictions in his Burnaby riding when he was an MP very recently. And he has identified this in a couple interviews and at a mayoral debate as being a smear campaign against him.
Right.
Because he was, you know, a member of parliament. It's a federal level of government, but so he couldn't do anything. And so he says, but people still think he should have spoken out. So he's right. called this a smear campaign as opposed to, I guess, alternatively, he might have said, like, yeah, I'm sorry, I could have spoken out more.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I think it's, yeah, it's an interesting one. I think often, if you're talking about smear campaigns and talking about the negative ads that your opponents run against you, you're kind of helping them in many ways, in my view. I mean, you're just helping to get more airtime, more attention on whatever issues they're trying to raise about you. If they're controlling the agenda, they're going to keep talking about their negative ads about you. It's a missed opportunity to talk about whatever platform you're bringing forward or whatever message you want to bring forward. And, you know, it's sort of a classic media training technique that, you know, whether it's in politics or elsewhere, whenever you're getting anybody ready for an interview, getting them to prepare their key messages well in advance of an interview, and regardless of what the questions that they're getting are, making sure that they're sticking to their agenda and the points that they want to get across. And when you start talking about something being a smear campaign, I don't know how effective that is.
Yeah, I get, but by identifying it as a smear campaign, is that still giving attention to your criticizers? Like, just by calling it that, is that what you're
that
saying?
That would be my assessment. You're just helping draw more attention to the issue. I'm not sure it's doing him any favors.
Right.
Another one of the main themes that we've seen throughout this election has been the large number of independents running. But without this party affiliation, what are some effective tactics you've seen candidates use to get recognized?
Yeah, it's usually, for independent candidates, extremely hard to break through. And I mean, that's why you see, in a Vancouver context, these municipal parties and electors organizations that have sprung up around each of the municipalities around the Lower Mainland to build out a slate of candidates to run together. And it's certainly, as an independent candidate, normally much harder to get name recognition, much harder to break through. I think that's the general rule. I think this election is proving sort of the exception to that rule. With Kennedy Stewart, I mean, you've got somebody who obviously is a federal MP coming into this really fractured race with sort of the disarray on the MPA side and on the Vision side, you know, having that name recognition coming in as a federal MP, you know, was quickly able to establish himself as one of the leading candidates going into the election. And I also think, just given the state of Vision and where it was, it made sense for him to maintain that independence. I mean, he in many ways is the de facto Vision candidate, but doesn't want to be branded as such. And particularly coming into this election, didn't want to be branded as such because all the polling, everything was saying it was going to be unwinnable to be the Vision candidate. That, you know, the party had, its popularity had certainly trended down in recent years. And there was a lot of uncertainty what was going to happen with Mayor Robertson, whether he was running again or not. And as a result, it did not look like the Vision brand was one that anyone necessarily wanted to attach themselves to. And by remaining independent, he's managed to bring together this coalition of voters across the left, which looks like it's been a very effective tactic so far.
And it also seems like Kennedy has used endorsements very much to his benefit to bolster his brand. Is that something you see as a sort of tactic independents can take to stand out from the crowd?
For sure, absolutely. Helps lend that credibility to them, for sure, and helps. Helps give them some momentum going through the campaign. I mean, often you'll see people sort of roll out various different endorsements throughout the course of the campaign and try and build up some momentum around that. The other one that I think is sort of interesting in terms of independent candidates on the MPA side, Aaron Shum, who from the school board, who, you know, again, normally probably would not be have nearly as good of a chance of winning as an independent candidate, but given sort of how fractious the race is this time around, from the school board, who, you know, again, normally probably would not be have nearly as good of a chance of winning as an independent candidate, but given sort of how fractious the race is this time around, and some notoriety and name recognition that she got from leaving the school board and her break from the NPA, may play to her advantage as well.
Right. So we're basically done. I know you have to go. I was wondering, though, just to tack back to the difference between sort of positive and negative general messaging in an election. Have you seen trends during your time in politics that parties who tend to use more negative or positive messaging tend to be those who are like the underdog or the ones who are winning, or groups that are targeting more conservative or more progressive types? Or do you think it's just all across the board, just depends on the certain election and electorate?
Unfortunately, I think it's much more the latter than the former. I mean, I wish it could be isolated to one side of the political spectrum or just to losing campaigns, but you tend to see negative ads certainly across the board, and more of them. I was looking at a university down in the U.S. who had done some research looking at the last four presidential elections, and they were saying back in, you know, if you look at the 2000 campaign, about 30% of ads were negative then. By the 2012 campaign, that had already jumped to 60%, and I would suspect it's only increased since. And I think that's a big part of why you see an electorate that's as polarized and divided as it is, certainly in the U.S., but really across the board.
Right. So
it definitely has an impact.
Right. So there is no sort of one side or one political belief that is using negative ads more, but overall the trend has move towards more and more negative ads and messaging overall?
Absolutely.
Cool. And then the last question is just how would you say generally PR strategies in municipal elections compare on the whole with, say, provincial or federal elections?
That's a good question. One of the big differences is just the scale, right? I mean, you've got certainly not the same budgets involved in a municipal campaign as you've got in a national campaign. The one thing that I think the commonality between them, though, and one of the things that you're seeing more and more is as more and more campaign advertising moves online, more and more very targeted messaging, just trying to reach very specific segments of the electorate. And certainly that's an effective strategy and can help you win a campaign. I think for politics overall, it definitely has a bit of a negative downside as well, though, because you're reaching more specific audiences, often with more divisive messages, and you're also seeing campaigns willing to you know, in on social media ads, whether it's Facebook or elsewhere, take a more negative tact because they know they can micro-target that message to an audience that that's going to appeal to, and not have to worry so much about any backlash that they might experience with that negative messaging being seen by the whole electorate.
Cool. Great. Well, thank you so much for your time, David.
All right. And that was an interview with David Brody. I think I had previously introduced him as Malcolm Brody. So sorry about that.
That was an interview with a man. I'm kind of like male named. Gentleman,
yeah,
fellow.
Something European. We're not sure.
It was very Anglo.
I feel like I need... I'm pretty sure it's David. Yeah, it is. It is. Double checking, and my apologies, David Brody of Citizen Relations. This has been a really challenging show to put together. So, okay. Thanks for listening. We just want to thank you. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Please listen to Seeking Office. Download our podcast. On the election, we're going to have a couple episodes coming up soon. We're going to have a really cool documentary look at the Park Board. Do you know what the Park Board does? Why does it matter? Did you know we're one of the only cities in North America to have one? Well, take a listen in the future to Seeking Office. Also, the Park Board's doing some reconciliation work, so it's like really interesting to learn about that because they had been quite a colonial force in removing Indigenous people from parks like Stanley Park in the past, and now they're trying to, you know, reconcile with Indigenous communities. So we're going to look at that. Also, we have an election night party. Election night, as you know, is October 20th. Woo! Saturday, October 20th. It's going to be really fun. It's at the Lido, which is basically at Fraser and Broadway. Just a sick bar, a great bar. And there's going to be trivia, and there's going to be fun times, and there's going to be we're going to have the election results as they come in playing. So please come down for that. All right, so have a great night. Tune in next Thursday at 5 p.m. for Democracy Watch. And up next is Flashback with Alex Christensen. So enjoy that, and we will see you next week.